Namacharya Srila Haridasa Thakur ki jai. Prem Shri Kaur Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shri Vasari Gaur Bhaktivinoda ki jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinath Shyamakunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana ki jai. Vrindavan Dhamma ki jai. Mathura Dhamma ki jai. Navadvipa Mayapur Dhamma ki jai. Jagannath Puri Dhamma ki jai. Gangamaya Jamuna Devi ki jai, Bhakti Devi ki jai, Tulsi Maharani ki jai, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda ki jai, Gaura Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga, all glories to Sri Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhujale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Vita Nama Namaste Sarasvati Deva Gauravani Pachami Nirise Sisina Hari Paskachade Sita Vande Ham Shri Guru Shri Uta Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Shcha Shri Rupam Sadvajatam Sahagana Raghavatam Vikam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvajutam Padijana Sarita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam So it's the 31st of December 2016 at the Otaki Festival in New Zealand, and we're going to be going through the Nectar of Devotion. So I'm going to be reading exclusively from the preface, but also giving just a very, very brief overview of the Nectar of Devotion as well. So, at least personally, I find the preface to the Nectar Devotion to be one of the most wonderful of anything in Srila Prabhupada's books. It's something that I've read many more times than I can count. And it's one of those many places, where you find everything in one place. You know, there's certain purports also like that. You say, oh, this purport is the whole synopsis of Krishna consciousness. It's like that with the preface. I'm not reading everything in the preface, that would be too long. I'm going to read little bits of it. So Prabhupada writes, Bhakti means devotional service. Every service has some attractive feature which drives the servitor progressively on and on. Every one of us within this world is perpetually engaged in some sort of service, and the impetus for such service is the pleasure we derive from it. Driven by affection for his wife and children, a family man works day and night. A philanthropist works in the same way for love of the greater family, and a nationalist for the cause of his country and countrymen. The force that drives the philanthropist, the householder, and the nationalist is called rasa, or a kind of mellow relationship whose taste is very sweet. So, this is a very important thing to understand. We were talking the other day, one of the ladies asked about being drained at work, right? And I was saying, this principle of understanding that everyone is looking for rasa, everyone is working for rasa, enables us to say, well, even though people are acting improperly, they're looking for Krishna. And you can connect with that aspect of the soul that's looking for Krishna, however wrongly their method or their location in which they are looking. This principle that everything we do is motivated by rasa is also extremely helpful in getting rid of any of our bad habits or our struggles. And I think that one reason that we have difficulty getting rid of bad habits and struggles is that we don't want to admit that we're actually looking for rasa in them. If we're doing something that we know is wrong, or we're doing something that we really don't want to do, that it's an impediment in our bhakti, that's an impediment in our life, we tend to characterize those things as simply negative. You know, I'm doing this because I'm weak, I'm doing this because I'm an idiot, and that all may be true. But we're also doing those things because we're looking for some kind of rasa, and if we didn't think that we were getting some kind of rasa from them, we wouldn't do them. Anybody follow this logic? Whatever we are doing, anything we are doing, according to this preface from Srila Prabhupada, is because we are enjoying some kind of rasa. So, with those things that we would like to eliminate or cut down in our life, it's very good to ask yourself, what rasa or combination of rasa do I believe I am getting from this thing? Now, what happens if you're also engaged in chanting Hare Krishna and eating prasadam and the process of bhakti is as soon as you identify what rasa you think you're getting from the thing, you will immediately understand what Prabhupada goes on to say here. Bhakti rasa is a mellow different from the ordinary rasa enjoyed by mundane workers. Mundane workers labor very hard day and night in order to relish a certain kind of rasa, which is understood as sense gratification. The relish or taste of the mundane rasa does not long endure. And therefore, mundane workers are always apt to change their position of enjoyment. A businessman is not satisfied by working the whole week, therefore wanting a change for the weekend, he goes to a place where he tries to forget his business activities. Then, after the weekend is spent in forgetfulness, he again changes his position and resumes his actual business activities. Material engagement means accepting a particular status for some time and then changing it. This position of changing back and forth is technically known as bhavatiya, which means a position of alternating sense enjoyment and renunciation. A living entity cannot steadily remain either in sense enjoyment or in renunciation. Change is going on perpetually, and we cannot be happy in either state because of our eternal constitutional position. Sense gratification does not endure for long and is therefore called chakula sukha, or flickering happiness. Skipping a little bit. Bhakti rasa, however, the mellow relished in the transcendental loving service of the Lord, does not finish with the end of life. It continues perpetually and is therefore called amrita, that which does not die. So once we identify what rasa we're trying to enjoy, if we look at it intelligently, we'll see that whatever happiness we're getting, we want to identify what kind of happiness am I getting? Am I getting chivalrous happiness? Am I getting anger happiness? That's one of the rasas, yes? Anger is one of the rasas. Am I getting fear happiness? Am I getting friendship happiness? We're getting some kind of combination of happiness. What? And then we'll look at it and say, huh, but it's not very much. It's very small. It's a very small quantity, and it doesn't stay. It's not a very high quality of happiness. It's not very high in its nature, and it's not very high in its duration. And in fact, Ayat Maharaj was talking about this the other day also, we become satiated. Yes, have you noticed this? That we become satiated. You're like, okay, enough pizza. We become satiated because we just can't enjoy anymore at that moment. You know, our stomach becomes full or whatever, our eyes are popping out of their sockets or whatever, you know, we just simply can't enjoy anymore. We've reached our satiation point. But also the thing becomes boring. So if you have pizza for breakfast, pizza for lunch, pizza for dinner, pizza for breakfast, pizza for lunch, after a while, you're like, give me something else. Give me lasagna, right? You just like want some variety. And if you really overdo it, I read about this one guy as a teenager. He worked in an ice cream parlor, and one of the perks was he got to eat as much ice cream as he wanted. And he ended up eating ice cream to the point of being nauseated. So that then he said for the rest of his life, he's not been able to eat ice cream. He said, in fact, he has trouble eating sugar of any kind, which may not be a bad thing. But the point is that he so much overdosed on the sense enjoyment, it became not only boring, but repulsive. So therefore, in order to enjoy material rasa, you need to do a bhogatyaga. You need to enjoy it and then get away from it, and enjoy it and get away from it, and enjoy it and get away from it, and enjoy it and get away from it. Anything that you have to get away from in order to enjoy it cannot be intrinsically enjoyable. Does this make logical sense to everybody? If something was intrinsically enjoyable, you should be able to keep enjoying it. So if you look at the nature, see, if we're just in denial and we say, no, I'm not getting any pleasure out of this, it's just some bad habit, it's just some this and that, you can never really deal with it. But if you look at it and say, well, this is what I'm trying to enjoy, but is it actually enjoyable? Prabhupada writes in the first canto that the way we become free from Maya is we see its naked form. Basically, the curtain of illusion is removed and you see it for what it really is. Of course, because we are Anandamaya Vyasat, because we are enjoying beings by nature, we have to have some kind of rasa. No matter how much we see the nature of material rasa, we will not be able to give it up if we don't have something that's genuine. Does that also make sense to everybody? I mean, we're not really willing to starve long term. You know, if there's nothing good to eat, we will eventually eat things that we don't like or are unhealthy for us just because we're so hungry. And this is the problem, klesho dikacharastesham avyaktasrapitejasam avyakta. This is the problem with processes of yoga that just emphasize detachment and renunciation. Because it's almost impossible for a conditioned living being to become completely detached and renounced from material sense gratification in 1 second. If that were possible, if we could, you know, then those processes might make some sense on one level. But we can't do that. And therefore, a person is basically becoming more and more and more detached without anything to replace it with. It's like you're becoming more and more and more empty. And it's a very unnatural situation for the soul. So we want to recognize that I'm trying to get, what is the pleasure I'm trying to get from this thing? Is that a real pleasure? And then we want to say, all right, well, if that's not a real pleasure, what am I going to put in its place? And again, we've seen so many people who say, oh yes, it's right, you know, I don't want to be part of the material world. And then they just go back to it in another form, yes? That's what happened when Prabhupada first was preaching in the West. He was preaching to the hippies. Of course, hippies didn't call themselves hippies. Other people called them that. But he was preaching to the members of the counterculture. And these were people who had rejected the materialism of their parents and of society. You know, we don't want a big house with a fancy car and this kind of stuff. But they were just going for a different kind of sense gratification. Understand that? They were just saying, okay, let's just have, instead of alcohol, we'll smoke marijuana. That was basically, you know, instead of having a family with kids, and then we'll just have illicit relationships. So they were basically substituting, actually they went from the mode of passion to the mode of ignorance, but, you know, we're just going to substitute because there wasn't something better. Again, we're skipping a little bit. Adoption of bhakti rasa, or Krishna consciousness, will immediately bring one to an auspicious life free of anxieties and will bless one with transcendental existence, thus minimizing the value of liberation. So here in the preface, Srila Prabhupada is summarizing these six qualities of bhakti. Does anyone know what the six qualities of bhakti are? Six symptoms. Oh, wow, Sanskrit. Maybe in English for some people who don't know Sanskrit. Auspiciousness. Relief from material distress.
Attracts Krishna.
Makes liberation insignificant. Two more. Full of incalculable bliss. That's the Sandra. And very rare. So here Prabhupada is summarizing this. Thus minimizing the value of liberation. Bhakti rasa itself is sufficient to produce a feeling of liberation because it attracts the attention of the Supreme Lord Krishna. So let's look at these qualities for a minute. Relief from material distress. So does that mean as soon as you start practicing bhakti and experiencing some of the bhakti rasa and that you don't get sick? Right? My granddaughter is now sick in bed with whatever bug is going around. Does it mean that you can't become poor? Does it mean that everybody will always be nice to you? That's a really funny one. And does it mean you won't have any earthquakes? Oh, so what does it mean, relief from distress? Yes? You're not affected by it. And that's because you're experiencing something higher and better. And again, materially, we all have an experience of this. We all have an experience that if I'm fully absorbed in something, I don't so much notice or get affected by things in my environment, isn't it? Right? If you're going to be going to Vrindavan tomorrow, and you're just thinking about that. And then, you know, if somebody bumps into you or insults you or whatever, you just, who cares? I'm going to burn down. But you have something else that's absorbing your consciousness. Yes, we all have experience of this. You don't notice other things. So what to speak if one's absorbed in the reality? And it's very nice that we don't have time to go into this in depth today. But the fall-down sequence in the Bhagavad Gita, which is Bhagavad Gita 2, 62 to 63, right after that, in 64, Krishna talks a lot, and that whole section in many places in Bhagavad Gita, about this process of becoming free. And that is that you don't contemplate. You don't contemplate. You neither grasp nor reject. Neither attraction nor aversion. It's just like rivers going into the ocean. Right? The rivers flow into the ocean. There's a place in Hawaii where there's a river flowing into the ocean. And depending on the tide, you know exactly, sometimes the ocean is flowing back into the river. Which part of it is sweet, which part of it is salty. But the ocean doesn't overflow, no matter how many rivers flow into it. And so the material happiness, material and distress, it's just like, oh, okay. But it doesn't have anything to do with you. You don't grasp it and try to enjoy it, nor do you push it away and try to get rid of it. Generally, Prabhupada is saying, going on, neophyte devotees are anxious to see Krishna or God, but God cannot be seen or known by our present materially blunt senses. The process of devotional service, and it is recommended in the Nectar Devotion, will gradually elevate one from the material condition of life to the spiritual status, wherein the devotee becomes purified of all designations. We talked about this little day in Manashiksha with what section of Manashiksha? Being free from what? Anybody remember? Yeah, but which particular prize was about designations? Anyone remember?
Dharma.
Yes, Dharma and Adharma. Exactly. Right? Because in the first verse, Raghunathas Goswami talks about being attached to everyone, everything in relationship with Krishna in the process. But you might be attached to Krishna, but still have a designation. You know, I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm a son, a daughter, a husband, a wife, a brahmachari, a grihastha. So the next verse, give up your designations. The senses can then become uncontaminated, being constantly in touch with bhakti rasa. When the purified senses are employed in the service of the Lord, one becomes situated in bhakti rasa life. Okay, so what verse is Prabhupada referring to here? Sarvapati Vinimutam Tapartani Nimalarishikesha Rishikina Sevanam Bhakti Vishija. So this, of course, is one of the two definitions of bhakti that are given by Rupa Goswami in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And the first one is Anya Bilasitasunyam Gangama Anavata Anukulana Krishna Yashivanam Bhakti Rita. So let's look at both of those verses. What is bhakti? What do we mean by bhakti? And these two verses very nicely explained it. So, anya bilasita sunyam. Sunya means devoid, zero, like you say. Nirva sesa sunyavani. So, anya bilasita sita. So, not to have any material desires, but this doesn't mean that you don't really care if you live or die at all. You know, if there's a car coming at you and you say, Krishna, save me! That's not considered a material desire. The point of Anya Bilasita Sunyam is that I'm not coming to Krishna specifically for my material desires. So most religions in the world are in that category, aren't they? I remember at one store at Christmas time, I saw some, you know, plastic Santa Claus with a long, long, long list that he was holding. So this is basically how people go to God. They go to God with a long list. Okay? Do we ever go to Krishna with a list? I have. Yeah. Okay, Krishna. Please get rid of the stomach ache, and please have my husband talk nice to me when he comes home, and we don't have enough money in the bank, and, you know, or even I want to go to Vrindavan, I haven't been to Vrindavan for a few years. But we have a list that we come to Krishna with, right? So people generally go to God with a list, and that whether or not God fulfills their desires is their evidence of his existence. So if you've ever read any of the inspirational Christian magazines, they're full of miracles like this. You know, this is what sustains people's faith. You know, my truck broke down at the side of the road, and I had to put on a new tire, and I realized that one of the bolts had fallen off, and I needed a particular size bolt, and I just prayed, "Dear Lord, I need this bolt." And as I said this prayer, another truck rolled down the highway and a bolt bounced off of it into my hand that was exactly the right size. There is a God. You know, I mean, those are cool stories, but that's the essence of their religion. You know, that's it. My Aunt Sally had cancer and we all prayed and she got well. There is a God. God, glory to God. Right? And Prabhupada talks about the women in Germany in World War II who went to pray, you know, please, our husband, our son, our father, our brother, bring him back safe. And when they didn't come back at all, what to speak of safe, then they all became atheists. Of course, even on a material level, generally if you want something, you have to pay for it, as far as I know. You know, you can't usually place an order. Like Prabhupada says, don't think of God as your order supplier. So you usually, if you place an order, you usually have to send some money also. Isn't it? I mean, could you go into a shop and just say, I believe you exist. I really do believe you exist. Please give me the TV. Yeah. So this concept that if God doesn't give you exactly what you order, that he doesn't exist, and it's simply a matter of belief in him that gets you what you want, is rather childish, to say the least. So the Vedic understanding is that, okay, if you want to deal with God like that, he doesn't particularly like being dealt with like that, but if you want to deal with him like that, then you have to do the pious activities that he gives in the scriptures. And you have to perform good works. You have to earn what you get nicely in this world. But anyway, most people see religion like that. They see religion as, you know, how I can more effectively get my material desires fulfilled. Because vikarma is you just steal things, right? That's what vikarma is all about. You know, Mara's just talking about getting immediate gratification. So people right now, I want immediate gratification, immediate relief from distress, and I don't want to have to do anything pious to do it. I just, in any means. I mean, if I can do it nicely, fine, but if not, that's okay. I just want immediately. That's vikarma. And karma is, I want nice things and I'm willing to pay for them. I'm willing to sacrifice for them. And a religious person understands, not only should I sacrifice for them, I should also be thankful and grateful to the person who's providing them. That it's not coming automatically. It's like knowing that not only should I pay for things in a shop instead of stealing them, I should also smile at the cashier. You know, and say thank you to the cashier. So most people's religion is like that. Either they try to just get it by smiling at the cashier without paying, or they pay and smile at the cashier. But their purpose is simply to get something. And that's their definition of religion. So bhakti is not like that. Bhakti is, we're not going to Krishna because we want something from him. We may want something from him, I mean, just honestly. Sarvakama, moksha kama. We may have some desire. In fact, the neophyte devotee, by definition, has some desire. It's not that you have to be at prema to start bhakti. That would be a little peculiar. Then it would really be rare. If starting practice bhakti means you already had to be in pure love of God with no inartis, who could do it? There would be no meaning to practice bhakti. But although we have so many material, at least for myself, I have so many material desires, they would fill this whole room. Still, we're going to Krishna in order to develop love for him. Krishna, I come to you to develop love for you. I come to you because I want to love you. I haven't come to you for some other purpose. Right? Just like in medieval Europe, they would sometimes, or often, arrange marriages simply for some political purpose, right? You understand? The parents would say, okay, you marry this person because it will unite the kingdoms. There'll be a political purpose. Or sometimes people even marry like that. You know, they marry to get a visa. Yes? I'm sure we all know somebody like that. I'm sure we've all met somebody like that. No? So they're coming with some ulterior motive. You know, or they marry just to get money. A lot of scam artists on the internet are like this. You know, they pretend they have some interest in you, and actually they just want your money. So we shouldn't be going to Krishna like that. We shouldn't be going to Krishna professing love, but actually thinking, well, I really only want something from you. I mean, I actually know one devotee who got initiated by Srila Prabhupada. He had come to the movement to run away from being drafted into the military to fight in Vietnam. And there was a 10-year statute of limitation. And as soon as that 10 years were up, he left. You know, and he never really practiced Sadhana Bhakti, but he said, you know, I've just come here as a way to hide out from being drafted into the military. So one should not be like that. One should not be coming to Krishna, Krishna, I love you, Krishna, I love you, and when are you going to give me some money? When are you going to give me some money? So at least we should be feeling, I want to develop love of God. Or I want to develop love of God. I want to be free of my material desires. Or I want to be free of my material desires. Does this make sense to anybody? That's anyavilasita. Then jnana karma anavritam. That jnana and karma and adi, yoga, other things, should not be covering bhakti. So this is a very, these are all very deep things. We're really just skimming the surface here. And when I talk to devotees and notice devotees all over the world, when people are having difficulty in their bhakti, when there's some kind of dryness in their bhakti, so I've noticed that there's some general causes for that. One we talked about last night with the donkey urine bath, where you think you're getting purified, but actually you're not, because there's a disparity between your mentality and your behavior. Another reason, of course, is offenses, chief of which are offenses against the devotees. And some people particularly really struggle with this. I mean, I know some people who's like, I don't know, it's like they think it's their service to be offensive to the devotees. I'm sure you've met one or two of those also. Hopefully not yourself. But another cause of difficulty and dryness is mixing bhakti. And the reason for that is as soon as you mix bhakti, it becomes much slower and it becomes less full of rasa. So what do we mean by mixing bhakti? Because bhakti involves karma, involves activities, yes, we do things in bhakti. And it involves being, generally speaking, it involves being a good person in the world, right? Krishna doesn't want all of his devotees to be a bunch of criminals and lowlives. I mean, occasionally, it may involve doing things that aren't what we would call being a good person in the world. Like when I joined the movement, I had to disobey my mother to do so. My father supported it, but my mother didn't. And in our modern Western culture, that may seem like nothing, but like those of you who are from a more traditional culture, you know, disobeying your mother is a really heavy-duty thing. When Kunti said to the Pandavas, whatever you got, share it. You know, like we can't disobey our mother, and they were stuck. So that's a very adharmic thing, that I disobeyed my mother to move into the Hare Krishna temple. So sometimes there may be something like that, or we may distribute books in a place where it's illegal or something of that nature. In the beginning of the movement especially, we would do Harinam. In Australia, the devotees were thrown in jail over and over again for doing Harinam out on the streets. So occasionally the devotees may do something that is adharmic. from the normal perspective. But generally, devotees act in a dharmic way. And as far as Gyan, do we all study philosophy? Yes? Is there a lot of philosophy in the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam? And Chaitanya Charitamrita? Quite a lot. There's a lot of Sankhya philosophy. And we may also do, we should actually do, some of the elements of yoga. Like I was saying, neither grasping nor rejecting the thoughts and desires that pass through the mind. That's an element of yoga. So it's not that we don't do anything from karma, jnana, and yoga. Those are not sunyam. Those are not zero. But they're not to cover bhakti. What does it mean, covering bhakti? Covering bhakti is when we have a belief that those things are necessary for bhakti. And we think, I can't achieve bhakti unless I am a pious person. Is that true? Can you tell me some people in our shastras who came immediately to bhakti without being a pious person? Grari. Who else? Jaghai Madai. Who else? The prostitute who tempted Haridas.
Putina.
Putina. Oh, okay. Kupcha. Okay. So there's many examples of persons who were not situated in pious life and immediately came to bhakti. So I hear in some parts of our movement anyway, I hear people preaching that, you know, you must be a pious person in varnashram before you can do bhakti. That is karma mishra. No, you're not ready for bhakti yet. First you have to become a good human being. First you have to become a pious person. Then you can do bhakti. Your bhakti is not going to be effective unless you've already become... That's not a fact. You know, even there's one devotee who made this video and he said, you can't let people chant Hare Krishna until they're first following the four regular principles. So this is karma mishra bhakti. Bhakti is independent. Yes, Krishna wants us to act as pious people in the world, and it benefits us if we act as pious people in the world. Definitely. There's no doubt about it. But is it necessary for bhakti? No. Is it a necessary first for bhakti? No. Bhakti is independent. Then gyan. So gyan means detachment through philosophy, through intellectual understanding and development of good qualities. Some of you may know Adi Purushabhu. Any of you know Adi Purushabhu from the Ukraine?
Yeah.
He's one of the top shastric preachers in the world. Very wonderful devotee. And I remember he was talking in Ljubljana, Slovenia. He was saying how that he was making this mistake of Gyan Mishra Bhakti by thinking, I can't become attached to Krishna until I first have all good qualities. He said, what I realized I was doing was think, first I have to be liberated by yin, and then I can go to bhakti. So anytime we think, you know, first I have to be liberated by karma, then I can do bhakti. First I have to be liberated by yin, then I can do bhakti. You know, first I have to be detached from everything. I recently met a devotee like this also in South Africa, where he said, you know, I don't want to have any emotions for Krishna until I'm completely free of all material contamination. I said, Prabhu, that's Gyan Mishra Bhakti. You're mixing Gyan. You're thinking, I have to become perfect in Gyan first. If someone says, I can't have any attachment for Krishna, I can't have any emotion for Krishna until first I'm liberated, then I say to them, what process are you using to become liberated? After which, you can then have some attachment for Krishna. And you'll find they're going to go to karma again and occasionally yoga. I don't see very much yoga mishra bhakti in a Hare Krishna movement. I see some. You know, where a person thinks it's absolutely necessary to do asanas and pranayama for my japa or my japa won't work. You know, that's the kind of yoga mishra bhakti. I mean, certainly asana and pranayama are very helpful for meditation. But if you think they're absolutely necessary... It's just like this building is helpful for a class. It would be rather cold to be outside. But is it necessary? Do you understand the difference? If I think it's helpful and I can take it for bhakti, but if I think I require it for bhakti, or I have to do it first, you know, first I have to completely control my mind and my senses through yoga and breathing, and then I can become attached to Krishna. First I have to make my mind perfectly still through meditation. And people can even take up bhakti as if it were a yoga process. Okay, I'm just going to hear the name of Krishna the way the Buddhists meditate on their breath. Think about how Krishna as a person feels about that. Just think about that. It's like that you're going to use my name to become still and peaceful. Instead of I'm going to be with Krishna to be with Krishna. So these are all mixtures of bhakti. And because those are slower processes, karma yoga, gyan yoga, and dhyan yoga, especially in Kali Yuga, whatever, you know, it slows your bhakti down. And it just removes a lot of the rasa from bhakti. So this is another cause of dryness. All right, then Anukulena Krishna Nushilanam. So Anukulena, ala means to follow. So this is to follow the great acharyas, to do what is pleasing to Krishna. And of all the words in this verse, this is the most important, anukulena. The only thing you remember from this class today is this one word, anukulena, and you got it. To act in a way that has the intention of pleasing Krishna. That has the intention of pleasing Krishna. We talked about this with becoming Krishna's secret agent. That everything we do should have the intention of pleasing Krishna. Everything. In this way, everything becomes connected with Krishna. Whether you're working at a bank, whether you're feeding your baby, whether you're out distributing books, everything should have the intention of pleasing Krishna. And of course, we have two examples that's given in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Anybody know the two examples? Kamsa and? Going the other way is Yasoda. So Kamsa had no intention to please Krishna. But Krishna enjoyed fighting with him. Right? Have you ever enjoyed defeating an atheist? Hopefully you didn't punch them. But. And Mother Yasoda intended to please Krishna. She's thinking, you know, this is my son and he's not behaving properly. I have to train him nicely. How will he be a gentleman if he goes around stealing and lying and breaking things? You know. But was Krishna very happy with her behavior? No, he wasn't. He was angry. Right, when Mother Yasoda put him down when she was nursing him and she put him down to take care of the milk, was Krishna happy? No, he was angry. I mean, of course, that's another rasa. But at least externally, ostensibly, he was angry. When she tied him up, he was angry. Why are you tying me up? But her intention was to please Krishna. Her intention was to serve Krishna. So the intention has to be to serve Krishna, but it can't be concocted. You can't just say, you know, well, I'm going to smoke marijuana to please Krishna. People do things like that. But anukulena also means it has to be pleasing to Krishna as far as the authorities have taught us that Krishna is pleased. Just like I talked the other day about the six loving exchanges. If you really love someone, you give them food that they'll like. You guys are really good about that here in New Zealand. It's a real opulence here. That you really, you make prasadam such that people will like. If you give somebody a gift, you give them a gift that they will like. At least you try your best. If you speak to somebody, you speak to people about what they will like to hear. That's the intention. And how are you going to know that? How am I going to know what you like to eat? How am I going to know what gift you want? How am I going to know what you like to listen to? I have to know something about you, right? Isn't it? I mean, one of the difficulties that I have as a traveler is that very, very few people basically live on the road. Most people who travel, they go to a place and then they go home. And they stay home, and they stay home, and they stay home, and they stay home. And then they go to another place, and then they come home. But when you're going to a place, then 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 going to a place, it's a rather different kind of lifestyle. And so people often give me gifts that are very strange. You know, like a big glass bottle of olive oil. I mean, one devotee gave me 4 big glass bottles of honey. I'm going to take this on the plane. One of the funniest ones was at one temple when myself and a couple other devotees were helping them start a school. So they thanked us in front of the whole congregation, I don't know, 500 people. And they gave us a gift of a huge framed glass photograph of their deities. You know, humongous glass framed. You know, and it was a very expensive frame. But I was thinking, not only could I not put it in my suitcase, but if I wanted to ship it back to my home, it would have cost me a fortune just to ship the thing. So this comes from people not, you know, they, and I understand that my lifestyle is one that most people can't relate to. But if we're going to give somebody a gift, we have to have some idea, you know, who are they? What do they like? What do they appreciate? So Anukulena, in order to please Krishna, we have to know something about Krishna. We can't just make it up. This is, you know, one of the main reasons why we're vegetarian, because Krishna says, I don't want to eat meat. You know, you could argue as a universal form, he's eating the soldiers. Arjuna says, I see all the soldiers rushing into your mouth and being smashed between your teeth. So you could say, oh, you know, universal form, let's offer people. Therefore, one needs guru, sadhu, and shastra, not just shastra. Therefore, one needs to have a spiritual master. One needs to rely on the sadhus. The sadhus say, no, the important verse is pacham pushpam pulam toyam. That's the important verse. Not the one about the soldiers being smashed in the teeth of the universal form. What's important is to see, you know, what did Mother Yasoda and Mother Rohini, what did they cook for Krishna? They weren't cooking meat, fish, and eggs. So Anukulena, to always want to have the intention of pleasing Krishna. Now, if we always have the intention of pleasing Krishna, and we act as far as we are able to understand under the guidance of our authorities, then we will not be affected by the difficulties of the world. Affected by the difficulties of the world means we're trying to please somebody other than Krishna, or we are trying to please Krishna in a way that's not really pleasing to Krishna, which means we're not really trying to please Krishna. Okay? You all understand? Okay? If I say I'm trying to please you, but I haven't taken the time to find out what pleases you, then I don't really, on a deep level, want to please you. Okay? Why does that free us from all the difficulties of the world? Does anyone have any idea? And this relates to Sarvapati Vinirmuktam Tarpante, being free from designations. Why is this one point? Yes?
Is it because you're in your eternal constitutional position, therefore you're beyond the modes?
Oh, that's a beautiful answer. It immediately puts you in your eternal constitutional position beyond the modes. Yes, you're not affected by the modes. They're there. Krishna and Prabhupada in 1422-25, they're there, but you're not affected by them. Just like if you're walking through an electronics store with a friend and you're talking to your friend, and in the electronics store, you know, there's screens showing different movies, but you're just involved in your relationship with your friend, then you're not affected by what's on the screens. Yes? Everybody's had this experience? Somebody's shooting somebody, somebody's embracing somebody, but you're not watching it because you have something else going on. Okay, why else? As soon as we just have this intention of pleasing Krishna, are we not affected by the material world? Yes.
We experience a happiness that can't be taken away.
Yes, very nice, which Prabhupada, of course, talks about here in the preface. Anything else? Yes.
When unattached to the result of our action?
Yes. Huge one. Now that's the idea of karma yoga. Karma yoga is you become detached from the fruits of your actions by doing actions and giving away the fruits, doing actions, giving away the fruits. But with bhakti, as Krishna says, Arjuna, if you do bhakti, you automatically receive the results of karma jnana yoga. Yes? You all remember that verse? So as soon as I'm trying to please Krishna, then I'm no longer concerned about the external results in and of themselves. Like, what does Krishna say to become detached from? You remember the dualities?
Love and hate.
Love and hate, yes. Happiness and distress, what else?
Fame and infamy.
Heat and cold.
Heat and cold. Honor and dishonor. Friends and enemies. Friends, enemies, and neutral, auspicious, inauspicious. So why are we attached to all these things? Because we want a particular result, right? That we want to enjoy. I want honor, fame, friends, happiness, good temperature, because I want to enjoy it. What does it mean that I'm attached to friends and I want to push away enemies? It means people who are feeding my false ego, my senses or my false ego. Does this make sense to everybody? All these things are either about our senses, having something nice to eat, something nice to smell, something nice to see, something nice to hear, something nice to touch. Or my false ego, which is, you are great, you are wonderful, you are fantastic. You did a great job. That's basically material happiness in a nutshell. And you are great, you are wonderful, you did a great job is within the context of my false identity. Does everybody follow this? Now, I have a particular identity. I am a renunciate. I am a husband. I am a woman. I am a man. I am a mother. I am a computer programmer. Whatever it may be. I'm a Brazilian. I'm an Australian. And then we have a good something. What does a good computer programmer do? What does a good renunciate do? What does a good woman do? What does a good mother do? Is everybody following this? So I have an identity, I have a false identity, and then I have an ideal of that identity. Okay. So, I'm a grandmother. What do good grandmothers do? Okay, I will try to do that. And if I get feedback from the environment or other people that I'm doing that, yes, I'm happy. Everybody understanding this logic? Okay. But am I always a good whatever? Does that work? Do we always live up to our material ideals? Anybody here always? Any of us always a good son or daughter of our parents? Anybody here always a good spouse to their spouse? Always a good parent to your children? The renunciates, are you always the most pukka renunciate? No. And then we become disappointed. We become disappointed in ourselves. We become disappointed in others. Especially if I'm trying to please the other with my being a good something. I'm trying to please the head of the ashram by being a really good brahmacharya. And he says, you know, you're really nice. And then I become angry. And I said, I've been working so hard. I've sacrificed so much. What's wrong with you? Aren't you grateful? Aren't you appreciative? I don't know if I want to be in this Hare Krishna movement. People don't appreciate. But as soon as I'm just trying to please Krishna, as soon as my intention is to please Krishna, then I'm not affected by those things because that's not what I'm trying to achieve. Even success or failure. You can say, well, if you're trying to please Krishna, don't you want to be a success? Well, sure. You know, we don't intentionally give Krishna banana peels. We don't say, well, I'm just going to care about pleasing Krishna and he ate Vidura's banana peels, so I'm just going to put banana peels. If you're trying to build a temple, you actually want to build a temple. If you go out to distribute books, you actually want to distribute books. Right? But is Krishna's happiness dependent on that external result? Can you measure Krishna's happiness by that external result? In fact, Jiva Goswami says that those who maintain inattentiveness to their bhakti as they progress start measuring their bhakti by their external accomplishments. How many sticks of incense have I waved? How many rounds have I chanted? How many temples have I built? And so forth and so forth. Oh, okay, I must be advancing in bhakti. Can you think of somebody who pleased Krishna, although externally what they did was a failure?
Jatayu.
Excellent. Somebody else. Yes, definitely. When Prabhupada was first preaching in India. In Jhansi. Externally, that was a failure. And Prabhupada tried working with the Gaudiya Math. It didn't work. Yes? Excellent. Cowherd boys know into Yagi Brahmanas. I really like that example because Krishna personally told them to do it. So sometimes we think, well, okay, if things aren't working out for me, that must mean that I'm not aligned with what Krishna wants. That, you know, if the externals in my life aren't working out, it must mean that I'm selfish. Because if I was doing what Krishna wanted, then everything external in my life would be perfect. You follow? We have this idea. But Krishna told the cowherd boys, go beg from the Yagi Brahmanas. And Kavi Kandapur in Anandavrindavan Temple has the cowherd boys coming back and saying, how did nectar become salty? How did your infallible instructions not work? You know, why were we given the silent treatment by the Brahmanas? And Krishna just sort of says, oh, you know, that happens when you beg. Sometimes people give you, sometimes people don't. Why did that really please Krishna? Can you imagine if the cowherd boys went first to the wives of the Brahmanas? That we didn't have the contrast between the wives and the Brahmanas. Would the wives be as glorified? No. So that refusal of the Yagi Brahmanas, and I'm sure Krishna had a reasonably good idea that they would refuse. You know, that refusal of the Yagi Brahmanas served to further glorify their wives. Any other instance? Yes?
Maharaj
Ambarish
with Nurvasa,
and
Nurvasa became angry.
I never thought of that.
Wanted to kill him.
Yeah, so Ambarish failed to be a good host, didn't he? He really messed up being a good host. But Krishna was very pleased. Yes?
Hanuman.
Where was he a failure?
Well, initially he went to get Sita and he didn't get
him. Oh, okay. So he had quite a series of failures before he finally found Sita. Yeah, he did. Actually, they'd overstayed their time. And they were afraid when they got to the shore of the ocean, they were afraid to go back because they thought, you know, we've been gone longer than we were supposed to be gone and we haven't found Sita and what will we do? Arjuna protecting Krishna's queens, yes. Yes? Yudhisthira Maharaj, yeah, he really messed up with the gambling, didn't he? But why did it please Krishna? Because Yudhisthira can't do anything that's adharmic. You know that, right? Can't even think anything that's adharmic. Wouldn't that be nice if you couldn't have an adharmic thought? Yes. Vibhishana, yes, he appeared to be a failure. He was renounced by his brother. But why did Yudhisthira please Krishna? That's a very excellent example. You know, Krishna sometimes wants his devotees to set bad examples. Because people will say, well, you know, I could gamble and not be affected. Well, if Yudhisthira could be affected, I don't think there's any hope for you. Understand? If even Yudhisthira became affected. Dharmaraj. If he got so addled that he gambled away his own family members, then how can you say, I can gamble and not be affected? The cowherd men, when they were trying to prevent the cows from running down Govardhan Hill, to see their cows, who were actually Krishna. And it said they were baffled and angry at their failure. They came down Govardhan Hill. How many of you have been to Govardhan Hill? Would you want to run down Govardhan Hill? And cows are not like goats. You know, they're a little awkward, cows. And they were running with joint front and rear legs. You've all seen cows run like that? Right? Could you imagine a cow running like that down Govardhan Hill? Wow. You know, I mean, you'd have to really want to get to the bottom. And the cowherd men, I'm sure they had their sticks out. You know? And they were baffled by their failure. But Krishna was very pleased because it showed the devotion of the cows. So when we just want to please Krishna, then even if to the rest of the world we look like a failure, it doesn't affect us because Krishna is pleased. Even if others say, you know, you're a lousy this, you're a lousy that, but I was never trying to be a this or that. Does this make sense to everybody? Of course we should try to, you know, treat other people nicely in order to please Krishna, but they may not appreciate it. We've all had this experience. You're doing your best to please somebody and they may not be pleased. Maybe they have their stomach ache that morning, or who knows? Or they misinterpret your actions. But if we're just trying to please Krishna, then even if the person is not pleased, we're still satisfied. Even if everything's a failure, we're still satisfied. Even if the whole world condemns us, we're still satisfied. And that is how the devotee becomes detached. The karma yogi becomes detached in these things by giving up the fruits. The jnana yogi by philosophically meditating on them, on the nature of honor and dishonor, the nature of pleasure and pain, the nature of friends and enemies. I don't want it anymore. The yogi through mechanically controlling the breathing and the mind to put the mind in sattva guna. The devotee by concentrating on Krishna's smile. And as long as I'm trying to get Krishna to smile, then shilanam. Shilanam means in action. And both physical action and emotional action. Not only physical and not only emotional. Therefore, we have devotional service. Not just, like that brahmana who was poor, so he just meditated on serving Krishna. But he was poor. He didn't have anything. So we should meditate on serving Krishna and also actively serve him. So this is the main definition of bhakti. Okay. When the purified senses are employed in the service of the Lord, one becomes situated in bhakti rasa life, and any action performed for the satisfaction of Krishna in this transcendental bhakti rasa stage of life can be relished perpetually. So when we have this mood, free from designations, just trying to satisfy Krishna, it's not the kind of happiness we need to renounce. It's the kind of happiness that keeps getting better and better and better. When one is thus, probably going on, when one is thus engaged in devotional service, all varieties of rasas or mellows turn into eternity. Okay, now Prabhupada's starting to talk about sadhana bhakti. He says, in the beginning one is trained according to the principles of regulation under the guidance of the acharya or spiritual master, and gradually when one is elevated, devotional service becomes automatic and is characterized by spontaneous eagerness to serve Krishna. There are 12 kinds of rasas, as will be explained in this book, and by renovating, what does to renovate mean?
To make better.
And to, like Prabhupada will use the word, restore, revive. Right? Our relationship with Krishna in 5 primary rasas, we can live eternally in full knowledge and bliss. So here Prabhupada again is referring to the 2 stages of sadhana bhakti, and in a very concise way, and going on to bhava and prema bhakti, which we'll discuss more in a little bit, but just discussing it briefly. So there's two varieties of sadhana or practice or abhyas bhakti. So why do we have to do practice bhakti at all? I mean, it seems kind of odd. Bhakti is about love and devotion. How do you practice love? seems rather odd to us. It seems to us that we should just love. Right? But the problem is that we become attached to this mundane rasa, which has covered our natural love for Krishna. And therefore it has to be practiced. And the example is giving of a child who learns how to walk. So the newborn child, a baby right after it's born, if you hold it up, it will naturally put one foot in front of another. That's one of the tests they do after a baby's born to see if it's healthy, as part of what's called the Akar score. So the propensity to walk is in us. The propensity for ballet dancing is not in us. The propensity for walking is in us. And by practicing, that comes out. It naturally manifests itself to the point that I think all of us in this room walk automatically. Yes? Right? But we didn't always walk automatically. Even though walking is inherent in our body, it's inherent, it's built into our body. We didn't always walk automatically. When, at a certain age, we didn't walk at all. And when we learned how to walk, it was a very gradual thing. And you see little children who are first, you know, what we call walking, but they're not really walking. There was one in here the other day like that. Right? Where they walk like this, like they're a tightrope walker. Right? And they kind of walk from their hips. And you can see, if you look at them, that about half of their attention is on the process of walking. Right? And if they walk around the room and you're in the way, they'll fall on you. Yes? Their balance. But eventually, like now when I walk, I'm not doing that. I'm just walking. Right? So our sadhana is required because we've turned from Krishna. Or another example is that sobriety is our natural state. Yes? Being intoxicated is not a natural state. If someone becomes addicted to an intoxicant, someone becomes addicted to heroin, or they become addicted to alcohol, or they become addicted to nicotine or something like that, they have to go through a process to come back to their natural state of sobriety. Correct? They have to practice how to be sober. Something which, to those of us who've never been addicted to anything, you know, I never wake up in the morning and say, oh my God, what am I going to do without a cigarette? Or what am I going to do without a drink? Never. It doesn't happen. Because I never became addicted to anything. But once somebody becomes addicted, then they have to go through a process. And that process involves something deliberate. And something that seems to them as somewhat artificial. Does this make sense to everybody? It's not just that they can say, oh, I want to be sober, and because sobriety is natural, that as soon as I want to be sober, I'm going to be able to do it. And the process may even have some austerity involved in it. And if, you know, some doctor or treatment person is treating them, the doctor may ask them to do things to become sober that involve some austerity or difficulty. Is that the fault of the doctor? If a treatment program has some pain in it, some difficulty, some austerity, is that the doctor doesn't like the addicted person, the addict, and wants them to suffer? Is that where the pain's coming from? Where's the pain coming from?
Attachment.
Their own attachment to the substance. Right? How their physiology has changed and how their psychology has changed to become addicted. So in education, we talk about four steps in learning anything. One is called unconscious incompetence. This is when I would like to have a flip chart. And the next is called conscious incompetence. The next is called conscious competence. And the next is called unconscious competence. Unconscious incompetence, you're in Maya, you don't know you're in Maya. Now, Maharaj was talking about the modern people who don't even have the time to think about what's the goal of life, what am I doing, what's my philosophy of life. Then conscious incompetence is where you start to become aware, oh, I'm an illusion. I'm suffering. I'm wasting my life. This is really dumb what I'm doing. I'm not satisfied, but you're still doing it. Then conscious competence is when you do the right thing, but deliberately. Oh, okay, I'm supposed to chant Hare Krishna. I'm supposed to offer my food. I'm not supposed to blaspheme the Pope. You know, you're doing the right thing, but with deliberation. Then unconscious competence is you're just naturally doing the right thing. So all of us would like to jump from unconscious incompetence to unconscious competence. Because those two intermediate steps are uncomfortable. Especially the conscious incompetence is a very uncomfortable stage. To notice you're doing the wrong thing and still do it. To kind of catch yourself while you're doing it, or right after you've done it. Yes? And go, ooh. Ew. That was really bad. Whoa, that was all ego and envy in what I just did. Oops. You know, that's quite painful. It's not a pleasant experience. And in sadhana bhakti, my dear friends, that will happen. Nobody told me when I joined the Hare Krishna movement that would happen. And I've often wondered, if they had told me, would I have come? So I'm never quite sure if I should tell people that will happen or not. But I think I would have preferred to have been prepared. You know, you start seeing things honestly. You start seeing yourself honestly. And some of what you see, you don't only see, wow, I am a soul. Woohoo! You see that. But you also see, oh, wow. Do I have dirt on me? Oh, my God. And I'm attached to the dirt. Quitting rubbing it on me. You know? So you see that kind of stuff. So this is sadhana bhakti. Sadhana bhakti is conscious. You become conscious of how you're an illusion, and you consciously, okay, I should try to become attached to Krishna. You know, it's a little odd, isn't it? I'm going to try. But this happens, right? I'm sure that Jaishila and Bimala will tell us this happens in relationships in the world also. People may grow apart in their relationships. And then they have to make a conscious, deliberate effort to heal that relationship. Isn't that a thing? Right? It doesn't feel quite like the attraction they had in the beginning or at some point. Some people are not attracted to each other the first day. Sometimes that grows. And we always have people who fall in love with someone that they first hated. But it may not be just like that. It may be, you know, deliberate. You may have to get out your five drops book, right? Okay. We're fighting now. Get it. Where's the book? Okay. Which page? Step one, drop the flame. Okay, look. Let's just drop the flame, okay? How do I do that? Okay? And it may be like that. What was the next one? Drop the blame?
Vain.
Okay. How do we drop the flame? Okay. Now what do we do next? Step two. Drop the vein. Okay. Right? And whereas you guys were doing it automatically. And the presumption is that if you do it following the steps, that eventually it becomes natural, eventually becomes automated. Eventually you're not even conscious of what you're doing. And you're just doing it. And we've all had experience with learning things like that, right? You drive a car and you're just doing it. You're not really conscious. How is my foot on the clutch? How is my foot on the brake? So that is sadhana bhakti. And there's two divisions of sadhana bhakti, as Prabhupada's referring to here in the preface. One is where, we talked about this yesterday, our motive for doing bhakti is primarily a philosophical or intellectual conviction. We have some experience, we have some taste, and in fact, having some taste, Rupa Goswami says, is the qualification for taking up bhakti at all. Some attraction. Ravindasri Prabhu likes to tell about how Tamal Krishna Maharaj and Vishnu Jan Swami came to Philadelphia with their traveling bus. And Ravindasri Prabhu asked Tamal Krishna Maharaj, he said, how do you know who to preach to? And he said, well, you know, we're having a bhajan and then we distribute prasadam. And then I walk around and I ask people, you like the music? You like the food? And if they say, yeah, it's okay, I don't preach to them. If they say, wow, it's fantastic, then I preach to them. And Arvindasu Prabhu decided he would test this. So he went up to one, you know, different people, and one of them said, yeah, it's okay. And he spent like an hour and a half preaching to the guy. And the guy said, yeah, all good philosophy, but I'm not really interested. So the primary qualification is some sort of taste, some kind of attraction, which may come from previous lives. Ultimately, it comes from another devotee. But still, in regulative sadhana bhakti, there is some taste, there is some attraction, there may be some far-out spiritual experiences. I remember in Germany, this one, one gentleman was passing through and happened to stop at our temple. And for about 4 days, I was preaching to him mostly from a sociological perspective and about Varnashram and things like that. And then on the fifth day, he said, I think I'm going to try chanting. So he took a set of japa beads, this is at Simachalam, if any of you have been there, and he went out in the forest around the temple, and he came back after about a half an hour, and he says, whoa. Said, that should be a controlled substance. So, you know, we may have some amazing experience in kirtan or with prasadam or with some kind of service, but what's primarily driving in Vaidhi Bhakti is this intellectual conviction. The shastra makes sense, the guru makes sense, you know, all of this is yes, this is definitely what I want to be doing. And then at a certain point, which Prabhupada talks about, that generally it's somewhere at Anartha Nivritti, after a lot of the anarthas have been cleared, then the soul starts to wake up and say, oh, I actually really, really like Krishna. And I like Krishna in a particular way. I like Krishna. I really want to be Krishna's just servant. I really want to just run in the pasture and grounds with Krishna. I really want to take care of Krishna's cows. You know, I really want to dance with Krishna. You know, I really want to just carry Krishna around and take care of him. And some feeling comes up in the devotee. Just like in this world. Sometimes we meet a person and we just get a feeling. Right? Sometimes you meet a person and you're just like, oh, I want to be their friend. And sometimes that may be immediate, and sometimes it may be after you get to know them for some time, yes? Or you get you see a child, you're like, oh, I want to take care of them. And again, that may happen immediately, the first time you see the child, or after you know the child for some time. I really like to take care of them. Or romantic feelings, you know, maybe you just see some attractive person and go, wow. Or maybe you get to know somebody for a while, and after you know somebody, you're like, wow. So that's what happens with Krishna. Our original, I mean, that's a mundane example, but some idea. Our original inherent feeling for Krishna, once these anarthas start to become clear, Prabhupada sometimes will say 50%, then that feeling just spontaneously awakens. But when it's still in sadhana bhakti, that is still in practiced bhakti, it's not pure bhakti. And the main difference between regulative and spontaneous practice is the motive. And the other main difference in the practice is in spontaneous bhakti, you specifically meditate on the persons in Krishna Lila who exemplify the taste that has naturally arisen in you. Obviously, you meditate on everybody. It's not that you only read the chapters in Krishna book about the cowherd boys. You read everything in Krishna book, you relish everything to do with Krishna, but you make if what's arisen in you is I want to be Krishna's friend, then you particularly will meditate on Subal or Shudan or Mari Mangal or something like that. Okay? On here. Prabhupada says, this is what, again, just I love this part of the preface. The basic principle of the living condition is we have a general propensity to love someone. No one can live without loving someone else. Maybe the someone else we're loving is a virtual character on our computer screen. Maybe it's really misplaced. This propensity is present in every living being. Even an animal like a tiger has this loving propensity, at least in a dormant stage. It is certainly present in the human beings. The missing point, however, is where to repose our love so that everyone can become happy. At the present moment, the human society teaches one to love his country or family or his personal self, but there is no information where to repose a loving propensity so that everyone can become happy. The missing point is Krishna. And the nectar devotion teaches us how to stimulate our original love for Krishna and how to be situated in that position where we can enjoy our blissful life. How to simulate our love for Krishna. Prabhupada is here now referring to the different components of rasa, which we'll just summarize in a minute. In the primary stage, a child loves his parents, then his brothers and sisters, and as he daily grows up, he begins to love his family, society, community, country, nation, or even the whole human society. But the loving propensity is not satisfied even by loving all human society. That loving propensity remains imperfectly fulfilled until we know who is the supreme beloved. Our love can be fully satisfied only when it is reposed in Krishna. This theme is the sum and substance of the Nectar Devotion, which teaches us how to love Krishna in five transcendental mellows. Our loving propensity expands just as a vibration of light or air expands, but we do not know where it ends. The Nectar Devotion teaches us the science of loving every one of the living entities perfectly by the easy method of loving Krishna. We have failed to create peace and harmony in human society, even by such great attempts as the United Nations, because we do not know the right method. The method is very simple, but one has to understand it with a cool head. That reminds me of when some lady reporter asked Prabhupada why he shaved his head, and she was wearing a mini skirt. And Prabhupada said, "Why do you have bare legs?" He said, "We would rather have warm legs and a cool head." Prabhupada was so charming. The Nectar Devotion teaches all men how to perform the simple and natural method of loving Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If we learn how to love Krishna, then it's very easy to immediately and simultaneously love every living being. So this is the irony. If I try to love everyone individually, I will end up loving no one. And if I try to love Krishna, I will love everyone. So, of course, the Nectar Devotion goes on. We'll just really summarize the rest of the Nectar Devotion, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. As far as sadhana bhakti, Rupa Goswami gives 64 angas of bhakti, some of them have to do with seeing, some with smelling, some with tasting, some with hearing, some with the mind. He talks about the three most important angas of sadhana bhakti. Anybody know the three most important? Okay, to have a spiritual master, to surrender and serve the spiritual master, and to take initiation from the spiritual master. We're going to have initiation, tomorrow? Is that correct? Yes. And the five most potent items of devotional service? Reading Bhagavatam and Shastra? Living in the Dham, or making where you live into the Dham?
Kirtan.
Kirtan, japa, deity worship and association. And Rupa Goswami gives evidences for all the 64 angas of bhakti, and of course, any one of the angas of bhakti is potent enough. One time taking the charanamrita, one time following the rath part, is potent enough to bring love of God. There's the slight difference in Raghunuga sadhana, again, as we said, where you're doing all the 64 angas of bhakti, particularly those that nourish your particular mood, and you're meditating on following that resident of Vrindavan who exemplifies your mood. Then he talks about perfection, bhava and prema, that what happens in bhava and prema is that your heart becomes soft. Your heart becomes soft and melts in love of God. And what are the symptoms of having achieved bhava? Don't waste any time.
Attached
to chanting the holy name. Attached to living in a holy place. Attached to glorifying Krishna. Having a lot of faith, called hope against hope. Having a lot of eagerness, humility, perseverance, and detachment. All right, so once one is moving particularly out of regulative sadhana. By the way, can you move out from regulative sadhana to Raghunuga sadhana by your own efforts alone? Is it an intellectual thing? know, I once met a devotee who said that, I've been in regulative devotion long enough, time for me to be in spontaneous devotion. That doesn't work. That's really like a child saying, I've been a child long enough, time for me to be an adult. You know what? You're going to become an adult when you become an adult. Right? It happens on its own accord when it happens. It's not something that occurs naturally and spontaneously. But when that starts to happen, then one starts dealing with these elements of rasa. And of course, that it is fully manifest at the stage of prema. So Rupa Goswami spends the rest of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the rest of Nectar Devotion, is talking about these elements of rasa, or relationship with Krishna. So first he talks about that there are five elements of rasa, or relationship. So one element is the relationship itself, that's always there. The essential nature of that relationship, like we are friends. And that's the essential thing. You know, you have a friend, they're not your child, right? They're not your lover. They're not your servant. They're your friend. And there's a particular relationship called friend that is different. You know, if a friend starts acting like a servant too much, I mean, they can do some, but if they start acting too much like a servant, you're like, hey, yeah, this is a little weird. Or if they start acting like a master too much, or if they start trying to be your mother, you know, it's like, excuse me. So these are distinct, basic. And with everyone, we have there's varieties. You can be a superior friend. You can be a younger friend. Right? You understand? It's not that my friendship, I have lots and lots of friends, at least I hope they think I'm their friend. But my relationship or friendship with each of them is a little different. Still, there's some commonality of friendship. Right? Is this clear with everybody? So we each have some basic relationship with Krishna. Then there's also the 12 secondary rasas, which may also be very dominant in a particular individual. So a particular individual may have very dominant a chivalrous rasa with Krishna, although they're also a servant, or they're also a friend, or they may have a very dominant comedy relationship with Krishna, although they're very dominantly a lover. Everybody follow this? Yes? And sometimes the secondary rasas become very dominant. This also happens, you know, we also can understand this in our regular material thing, how we deal with people. Then there's the, so that's what's called the sthayi. Sthayi is like the Sanskrit word stay, what is stable, where you stay, right? What's solid, what's the basic relationship with Krishna. Then you have the vibhava. Vibhava is what stimulates, Prabhupada talked about in this preface, what stimulates our relationship with Krishna. So the main cause of our relationship with Krishna is Krishna. So is Krishna is the object of our relationship, and he himself is what brings out that particular feeling that we have with Krishna. As we mentioned the other day in relationship to Sadhusanga, the devotees who share a similar feeling to us also bring that out. You know, if when you see parents being loving with their child, the parents' love for their child may increase your feelings of love for that child. Right? You see the father's holding the child, and the affection between the father and the child increases your feeling of affection for the child. You're with a group of friends, and the way the friends are dealing with each other increases your feeling of friendship for your friends. Yes, you're with a group of disciples serving your guru, and the enthusiasm of the other God brothers, God sisters increases your own feeling of serving. So the devotees. In fact, without the devotees who have your own feeling, rasa is not possible. And then there's what's called the udipan. So that may be the way Krishna plays his flute, the way he stands, right? In one sense, you could say those are all Krishna himself. But the devotees are also counted in that category in a different way. So many things may bring out that love. And each of the different rasas have certain things that particularly stimulate their particular love. So those in friendship are particularly feeling friendship from certain things. Those who are in romantic attraction to Krishna are particularly stimulated by certain things. Does this make sense to everybody? Yes. So there's some analysis that Rupa Goswami gives of each of the primary and secondary rasas, and which stimulants especially apply to them. Then there's what's called the anubhavs. Anubhavs is how you behave in that relationship. Right? If I have a mood of service towards you, well, I bring you something to eat. I bring you something to wear. I clean your shoes. I do things. So these are the anubhavs. What you voluntarily do that expresses your loving relationship and that builds it. And again, these can be analyzed according to each rasa. So each rasa has a particular way of expressing their love for Krishna, which is going to be a little different from one rasa to the next. Then you have the sattvika bhavs. The sattvika bhavs are the involuntary way that you express your love for Krishna, or that it also increases your love for Krishna. So this is things like crying, or shivering, or a change of color, right? Just like, you know, if somebody feels romantic, they may blush. Yes? Embarrassed. So these things happen with Krishna, that people have some feeling towards Krishna. And this, and Rupa Goswami talks about levels of these. These can be like, you know, smoky and flaming. And many of them can happen at once, and how they combine with each other. And then he also talks about... Okay, Vyabhichari bhavs. The Vyabhichari bhavs are transient emotions. So when you love somebody, you don't generally feel angry at them, but you might feel angry at them sometimes. Or you don't generally feel afraid, but you might feel afraid sometimes. You know, someone you love is in danger, Krishna's in Kali's coils, you're like, oh, what's going to happen to Krishna? You understand? So these are like, they're not the main feeling that one has, but they're waves of emotion that come into one's general feeling for Krishna. And again, Rupa Goswami analyzes all of these four, the stimulants, the voluntary actions, the involuntary actions, and the transient emotions. He analyzes those four in relationship to the five primary feelings toward Krishna and the seven secondary feelings toward Krishna. How do each of these relate to each other? And he also talks about proper and improper mixing and combinations of these. And for each of these, he gives at least one example. Many times two or three or four examples, which is why you find that the latter parts of the Nectar Devotion are full of all these little stories. You know, I don't know what you call it, like little scenarios, little peaks at something. And I know, you know, Prabhupada produced Nectar Devotion very early in the Krishna consciousness movement, before most of us had any knowledge of who were these people. Like this morning, Nectar Devotion, I was hearing about the Cowherd Boys and about Madhu Mangal and Ujjwala and Subala. But, you know, when I first read Nectar Devotion, it's like, who is that? So it's so interesting that Prabhupada made this book available. I mean, I just keep being floored by this. That Srila Prabhupada made this book available to the general public. You know, we're going out distributing, selling this book in airports and train stations and shopping malls, and, you know, this very high esoteric science of rasa. So this is the basic idea of the Nectar Devotion. As I said, most important thing, if you only remember one thing, the intention to please Krishna. The intention to please Krishna. Because sometimes we can have the intention of pleasing somebody because we want to get something from them. I want to please you because you have good political connections. I want to please you because you have an extra piece of cake. You know, we have so many reasons we may want to please somebody. But the intention to please Krishna, just to please Krishna. And just to awaken our love for Krishna. And whatever other material desires, if you're like me, I have, as I said, a whole room full of them. Whatever other material desires we have, take those to Krishna. Don't try to fulfill them independently, please. Take them to Krishna and say, my dear Krishna, I have all these material desires. Please do with them whatever you like. please do with them whatever you like, and please give me ultimately only the desire to please you. Let me come to the point where I don't have any material desires even to bother you with ever, and let me come to the point that I only want to please you. So we have some 20 minutes for questions and discussion. Yes?
You were mentioning about how we need to become free from our parties of material designations. You mentioned it a couple of times in the class, so I was wondering now, because in Vedic culture there's a lot of emphasis on the body concept of life in terms of like understanding one's gender, one's vana, and even one's state of life in terms of ashram. So I was wondering in Krishna consciousness to what, and then there's also astrology, understanding one's particular nature. So then I was wondering in Krishna consciousness to what extent
that is an excellent question. So, to what extent should you pay attention to what vehicle you're driving? To what extent do you have to know, am I driving a skateboard? Am I driving a bicycle? Am I driving a motorcycle? Am I driving a Volkswagen? Am I driving a BMW? Am I driving a boat? You know, is it a rowboat? Is it a canoe? Is it a yacht? Is it a propeller plane? Is it a Dreamliner airplane? To what extent do you have to know that? Quite a significant extent. But if you think, I am the rowboat, that's a big problem. If you think my goal in life is to be a good rowboat, and your goal in life is to be a good skateboard, that's a very big problem. You will not be a very happy person. If you think my goal is to go to Krishna, there's Krishna. Got a skateboard. Okay, then I'm going to go to Krishna that way. That guy's flying a Dreamliner. He's going to go to Krishna a little differently than me. They're all going to Krishna. And don't be envious of other people's vehicles. What a waste of time. Then you just get their vehicle next life, you know. No, don't go there. That's true even with psychology. You know, if you're a shy person, I wish I could be more outgoing. If you're an outgoing person, I wish I could be more shy. Just forget about it. You know? It's just the mind. It's a machine also. Just whatever it is, it is. Who cares? But my body, my personality have so many faults. Okay? So what? Krishna says there's faults in everything, like smoke is covering fire. Everything has faults. Materially, everything has faults. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. We're not trying to, you know, change people from vicious kshatriyas, or that's not what it's really, it's not important. Find out what kind of vehicle you're driving, situate yourself according to that vehicle, and go to Krishna. And some of that changes. You know, Varna doesn't really change, although we only exhibit our Varna traditionally, you'd only exhibit your Varna as a grahasta, because Varna means your means of livelihood. So students retired and dead people don't have means of livelihood. So general livelihood was just for the grahastas. So that there may be some changes according to the ashram that we see, you know, it's psychology changes, just like some people were talking to me the other day and saying, you know, well, I didn't want to have children, and then I got to a point that I said, you know, I really want to have a child. So, you know, there's changes in that material identity that happen, and then a time comes where you say, God, you know, I really want to renounce this. We're done. You understand? So that kind of thing changes over the life cycle. The ashram system is basically how do you connect the natural psychological changes that happen biologically, psychologically in the life cycle to Krishna. And Varna is how do I connect the way I want to interact with the world, the way I want to impact the world, the way I want to earn a living. You know, how do I connect that to Krishna? That's basically all it is. I have to maintain my body. How do I connect? And I have some way that I want to exhibit my personality and my psychology in the world. I want to impact the world in some way. How do I do that for Krishna? That's one. So, yeah, it's good to understand that. Otherwise, you'll be doing someone else's stuff. And if you try to run your skateboard like it's a Dreamliner, it won't work very well. It'll be a little inconvenient. You know, or if you think, wow, you know, being a pilot, that's the best way, it's the fastest, but you don't know how to fly a plane. You don't have the money for the fuel. You get in the plane, you'll try to fly it, you'll just crash. And the guy in the skateboard, he's, you take Krishna Prema and you're in the hospital. Is that right? It's a practical matter. Yes?
I'm thinking about, you've been talking about, we have so many material desires.
I mean, I do, I don't know about anybody.
I have. Interrupt here. Twice we have heard Vaishnava Parada in this class.
Oh, no.
A certain person has said she has a room full of material desires. Now, factually speaking, we have never seen this yet. This is being stated, so I just want to make that correction.
It's a whole ocean. Thank you.
Well, I can say quite clearly that I have a room full of material. And probably I won't get corrected on that one. But it seems that Dhruva Maharaj, his material desires brought him to Krishna. So it wasn't that he was going to Krishna and saying, I'm sorry, I've got these material desires, you know, and I'm going to serve you anyway. He was going to Krishna because he really wanted to fulfill that material desire, and it seems that because he had such a passionate material desire, that fueled his devotional service much more than if he just sort of suppressed it and apologized to Krishna and tried to serve Krishna.
I don't suggest suppressing things.
Yeah. Well,
except very briefly in emergencies.
Yeah.
You know. Brief emergency suppression is necessary or we wouldn't have a civilization. As far as Dhruva, he came to pure bhakti. He didn't start out that way. And Narada tried to, and he wouldn't. He just said, no, I won't do that.
But it just seems like the strength of his desire sort of fueled his bhakti in a way that if he had accepted now.
Yeah, but Dhruva lamented.
He wouldn't have been so enthusiastic.
Well, okay. But he lamented. You know, he was... I don't think we want to lament like that. Do you really want Krishna to come and say to you, you know, instead of going back to God in 36,000 years, you can get the fulfillment of your material desires? Is that the way we want to go? And he was sorry. He said, I shouldn't have come like this. It was wrong. It wasn't the right way to approach the Lord. He came in pure devotional service, but he said, this, you know, that wasn't very intelligent. I mean, however you come, you come. You know, that's something else. But if possible, we should be guided by Rupa Goswami and by Srila Prabhupada and say, you know, even if my initial coming is like that, my initial coming to Krishna is I want to enjoy the world or I want to get free from distress or I'm just curious, or I should at least accept on the intellectual platform that, wait a minute, what I really should be looking for is love. At least we should accept it like that. And if we have some material desire, we go to Krishna and we say, Krishna, you know, I'd really like to get money, and so I'm coming to you. I'm not going to go to anyone else. Or I'd really like to get this, or whatever it may be. I'd like to become a famous rock star. And you know, I'm coming to you, and you can do with this as you like, and ultimately, please give me love. Ultimately, please bring me to the point where I'm not coming to you with this desire. but somehow connected with Krishna. Yes, definitely we should connect it with Krishna. If we don't connect things with Krishna, then that means you're saying, here's Krishna, and here's this. Prabhupada told wine drinkers to meditate on Krishna and the taste of their wine, for instance. It's not that he was encouraging wine drinking. But he's saying, if you're already drinking wine, then meditate on Krishna and the taste of your wine. So if we have a strong material desire, at least go to Krishna for it. But our main process of bhakti should be, I'm in bhakti because I want to develop love of God. There should be something like that. Dhruva didn't really have that. It came. He didn't really have that. But yeah, he lamented. And part of the reason that that's in the Bhagavatam and that it's in the Bhagavatam, where it is in the Bhagavatam, is, you know, we're trying to get to the point of Uttam Bhagavatam. Is that okay?
I mean, I understand what you're saying. I just wonder if he would have been so determined if he had that mentality.
Well, it's very interesting. We were talking last night about the thieves. Raghavdas Goswami talks about the thieves, Lust and his friends, Kamadi, and how they're bound us around the neck with the ropes of wicked deeds. And we discussed the fact that it's ours. Prakamam kamadi. It's our own lust. It's our own greed. And why are we maintaining this lust and envy and greed? Because we think it has some utility. That's why we maintain them. They're actually thieves who are binding us around the neck and forcing us to do things that we don't even want to do. I mean, they're very strange entities, one could say. You know, they're, Arjuna said, I feel like I'm being forced to do things I don't want to do. But it's our, we're maintaining someone who's forcing us to do things that we don't want to do. Which, if you think about that, just logically, is absurd. But why are we maintaining them? Because we're convinced we need them as motivators. Well, this material desire I have gives me so much passion that it gets me to chant my rounds. So I don't want to let go of it, because if I let go of it, then I lose all of my passion. And that's why we're holding on to it. And it's the same, you know, in the next verse with the donkey urine bath, but on a more subtle level. Because Bhaktivinoda says we're charmed by the donkey. So those are, again, things that we think, I need this for my bhakti. It's helping my bhakti. I mean, like one of the donkey urine baths is a person preaching just to attract the opposite sex. And, you know, I know this one brahmachari who decided that, you know, well, the householders really need help with the householder ashram, and we don't have enough householders helping the other householders, so I'm going to do it. And he has spent years now reading every book, watching every video he could about household life. So looking at that from the outside, you can really see, hey, that there's something wrong with that. And he's making that his main portfolio, teaching people, and he's never been married either. You know, you wonder how much you're really going to learn from a book. You know, so he's making this is his number one portfolio. And then he's also giving classes just to the ladies, how to be good ladies. You know, so I said to him, Prabhu, I don't think this is very wise. I said, first of all, you really don't have authority to speak about what you're speaking about. His renunciates can speak somewhat about these things, but better that people who are householders take that as, you know, their main portfolio. I said, and also, it's just opposed to your brahmachari dharma. It's not, you know, it's just not good for you as a person to be meditating on these things. And he said, I am, you know, I so much want to solve this problem, I am willing to sacrifice myself to do it. So, all of the anarthas we're holding on, whether they're gross or subtle, whether they're in speech, action, mind, or heart, we're holding on to all of those because we think that they're artists. We think that they're good things, and we wouldn't be holding on to them, which is where I went in the very, very beginning. Whatever we're doing because we think there's some rasa in it. Or we wouldn't be doing it. Look, what rasa am I trying to enjoy in this? And when we see, hey, wait a minute, this is actually not a very enjoyable thing that I'm doing. Let me find the real rasa. Then we will let it go. And we will see that everything we thought we were getting from those mundane things, we will get much, 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 much better in bhakti. Krishna says, those who take up bhakti are not bereft of the results of any of these other things. Determination in the mode of ignorance is just, yeah, someday I'm going to be rich. What's on the next channel? That's in the mode of ignorance, you know, or let me just buy a lottery ticket. Determination in the mode of passion is for a particular fruit. And as long as I'm working for that fruit and I think that fruit is attainable, I work hard. And as soon as there's some thing where I think, oh, the fruit isn't attainable, I give it up. Determination in the mode of goodness is steady in success or failure, sustained by, it's unbreakable, sustained by yoga practice. And determination in the mode of goodness comes from inner peace and equilibrium. So determination in sattva is much stronger than determination in rajas. But to speak of determination in bhakti is coming from love and attachment. When there's actual love and attachment, the person will do anything. There's no barrier, there's no obstacle, like a song when I was a kid, ain't no mountain high enough, ain't no river wide enough to keep me from getting to you, babe. Of course, materially that's not true. Just a song. But that concept. So we do not need material desires to make us determined in Krishna consciousness. We do not need any anartha for our Krishna consciousness. Is that all right? Anybody else? Yes. Jayshree.
I've been sitting thinking for quite a while about the question I want to ask, and I'm a little nervous to ask it, but I'm coming from a place, hopefully, of faith that Manashiksha, I understand, is for contemporary Vaishnavas who have also made their knowledge, I have read them. And my question is, in the early days, there was a Gopi Bhav club that came up around trying to understand our relationship with Krishna. Whatever mode it was, the intention quickly to pick it up with the highest. A loving relationship with Krishna.
Okay.
So I'm pretty sure that for contemporary Vaishnavas have very carefully considered the introduction of these subject matters and how it will be received and dealt with. Because,
well, hopefully, because as followers of Srila Prabhupada, is presenting these things. Yeah, sure.
You were listening really well, and
I'm
taking a while to get out.
Sorry.
So as I was listening, I was thinking, okay, so here's the brahmacharis or a group of grihasthas. We've heard all this discussion. The Srila Prabhupada originally did say that we have to follow a recipe of Vrindavan. My simple take on that is follow Srila Prabhupada. But I understand that Srila Prabhupada said you should read the books of the acharyas and go deeper into these subjects. So here I've got a bunch of brahmacharis or a bunch of grihasthas and ladies. This subject comes up, and now they're going to maybe talk to each other. What do you think? You're kind of more in the cowherd boy kind of group. How do you? And it's kind of natural to talk about what we hear and discuss. So my kind of, you get concern is, where do we take all this and not end up in a bunch of people over here, gopis, and another bunch of gopis, and this and that. And I've got a sense that's why Srila Prabhupada was very, very careful and concerned how to print Bhakti Rasamrita so that we make it available to the world through gopis.
Well, hopefully, as Prabhupada's followers, we take up his mood. We have to present the highest. Eventually, someday, hopefully, we all will be realized gopis and coward boys and cows. And
yay.
Prabhupada said we'll have another ISKCON in the spiritual sky. That doesn't mean there'll be GBC meetings. But that is our goal. That is our goal. And we should be talking about not only the forest of material enjoyment and not only the modes of material nature, but we should also be talking about how Krishna's killing the demons. And how Krishna's playing this. We have to talk about all of that. That's a fact. And we present the... What Srila Prabhupada did is he always presented the higher things in line with philosophy. I mean, one trend I've seen happening in ISKCON, and you won't find that there in the Manushiksha book at all, but one thing we find trending in ISKCON is people talking just about Leela divorced from philosophy, which Srila Prabhupada never did. Now, our Acharyas did that. I mean, we have books from our Acharyas that are just straight Leela with no philosophy at all. But Prabhupada didn't do that. And if we really follow Srila Prabhupada, I don't think that we should. So we should not just talk about, I mean, you could with some intimate friend, perhaps in your room, but not. We always discuss the higher topics in the context of philosophy and in the context of practice. And we always make the point that these things are not artificial. They have to come of their own accord when one is purified. Yes.
Since you brought up, in the closing minutes here,
yes,
you brought up about the so-called Gopi Bhavatav in Los Angeles. Let me clarify, I was there, not in the club. Some of my associates were caught up in it, and I was there when Srila Prabhupada came and busted it up. The problem was, they were... As Prabhupada said, they were just reading his own books. Mm. They were just reading those sections that they thought were the highest, and even pushing aside everything else, so much so that when they went to see Srila Prabhupada, they tried to tell him, and he became furious, that what's the point of hearing about Mother Yashoda? She's on the lower platform.
Oh my
and at
God.
That point, there was nuclear war.
Oh.
So they were an extreme case of misusing Prabhupada's own books. There was nothing else out there. So we can also keep that in mind.
Okay. Well, that's very helpful information. And then obviously that's a symptom of people doing things artificially. Because if someone naturally awakens to being a young gopi, you know what? They're also going to love Mother Yashoda. One of the, in Manushiksha, Bhaktivinoda lists different prayers in his commentary. And when Raghunath Das Goswami said to meditate on Lalita, one of his prayers to Lalita is how she is very dear to Mother Yashoda. All the same things that the person is already doing, but especially meditating on the other young gopis that have a similar mood. And that's what Rupa Goswami is saying. And also to get guidance, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati particularly says that one should get guidance from one's guru or one's seniors to purify one's understanding. And to find some other persons by the grace of the Lord who have similar understandings that can nourish one's further development. But externally, one will not be distinguishable from anybody else in the Hare Krishna.
I love that part of the answer, to confirm one's with one's...
That's very important. And with seniors, and that should be confirmed and purified by proper sangha.
Not by... So imagine the person next to you and have a chat about it, and then...
Probably not. Yeah, that probably would be good. But externally, I mean, and one will relish more Bhagavad Gita. I mean, a symptom that one is, it's genuine, one will feel unqualified. Some symptoms, if it's genuine, one will not feel qualified. One will feel unqualified. One will gain more relishing from Bhagavad Gita, Isha Upanishad, everything. You know, one will not say, oh, Bhagavad Gita, that's just me.
And they were saying that.
Yeah, so that's a prime symptom that is bogus. If someone says, now I am qualified, that's a prime symptom that is bogus. If someone says, oh, no, I'm not going to hear about Mother Yashoda or Bhagavad Gita, that's bogus. Is that right?
Yeah, and I'm not going to take my new realizations to my guru or the seniors. It'll be another disqualification.
Yes, exactly. Or advertising. Hey, everybody! No, that's another. Or if you start dressing like, you know, I'm going to wear a stick. I'm going to bring a stick and a buffalo horn to my right. Show Prabhupada Ki.